everyone. Today marks the one-year anniversary of our podcast. And I have mentioned a few times, we have some announcements for today. My first announcement is that we'll be having a draw through our Instagram account. The draw will be for the book I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara. So if you're not already following our Instagram account, please do, and you can participate in the draw. The second announcement that I'm making today is that after a year of putting the podcast out weekly, we're going to be switching the format a little bit. So you'll still be, for the most part, getting weekly episodes out, but you might notice that here and there I'll be skipping a week. Putting out a podcast is quite time-consuming, even for the shorter episodes, so just to give myself some time to catch up on life and work and on podcasting, and I'll always announce it the week before, but every probably 3 to 5 weeks, you'll notice that I won't be releasing an episode, and that's kind of going to depend on how life is unfolding at the time, but I will definitely give you a heads up the week before, just so that you don't expect anything the following week. But if you're interested in getting a little bit more content, we're also launching a Patreon. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Patreon, it's essentially a platform you can subscribe to. Different content creators are on there, and you subscribe to the account and receive some premium content. There's different tiers in our Patreon that will give you access to different content. If you are looking for a little bit more of us, you can go on our Patreon page and see what we have to offer there. There's a $5, $10, and $20 tier, so feel free to join whichever one best suits you. Depending on your tier, you'll be getting some reviews on true crime books, documentaries, and TV shows. We might try to figure out if we can host a book club somehow so that everyone can participate in it. You'll also be getting some breaking news in the true crime world, so maybe reporting on current events or current information coming out about certain cases. It's going to be a bit of a more relaxed, conversational atmosphere, and there'll be new content released monthly. So we're looking forward to seeing you on Patreon. Today's episode is going to be a two-parter, and the second part will be available immediately today on our Patreon. If you don't want to wait for it, you can subscribe and get access to it right away. Otherwise, you'll get to hear it next week as a regular release. Oh, and our first original release on Patreon for the month of March will be coming out next week, and it'll be a review and discussion of the book I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is the same book as we'll be drawing on the Instagram account, so hopefully you can join us for this. Now on to the episode. Hi, my name is Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this podcast, we discuss subjects that might be creepy to some, and sometimes even frightening. Some of our episodes will deal with serious subject matter, while others will be more lighthearted. Please keep in mind that I am not an expert on any of the topics I cover, just an interested party, and as always, listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone and welcome back. I'm Danielle.
And I'm Michelle.
And you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. This week's episode was supposed to be about the disappearance and murder of Amber Tuccaro. And it's still going to be that in part. But as I was researching her case, I discovered how many missing and murdered women there are from the downtown Edmonton core. And some that actually seem to be closely linked to Amber's case. So this episode ended up being much bigger than what I had originally intended. Today we're going to be focusing on 5 women of First Nations descent whose remains were discovered in the Leduc area of Alberta. Now get ready because we have a lot of information to go through. We're going to be discussing these women's disappearances in the order in which they went missing. None of these cases are solved.
Oh, wow.
So we're going to start with Edna Bernard. Edna was 28 years old when she went missing, according to the site justiceforNativeWomen.com. She was described by her family as a sweet, kind woman. She hadn't lived an easy life in her 28 short years. As a teenager, she'd been in foster care, and according to a CBC News article, she'd actually been involved in sex trafficking and drugs.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, they didn't go into any detail, but I'm assuming she was a victim of sex trafficking. She had six children, all of them were boys, and she loved them deeply. It's mentioned in more than one article that she had actually asked her mother to take care of her children if anything ever happened to her. It almost seems like she had this feeling that she wouldn't be around to take care of them.
Maybe if she knows that there was a risk of getting back into the sex trafficking thing, whether she was forced or not, she might have had that intuition to ask somebody to take care of the kids.
That's true. So, I mean, if she was still involved in drugs or concerned about, like you said, the drugs and sex trafficking being something that would happen again, she might have just been looking out for them, making sure that there was someone there for them. Her mother also wondered if she was afraid of something specific or someone specific.
Well, you would meet some nefarious people.
Yeah, in those circumstances, I'm sure there are some pretty shady characters that you would come across. On September 22nd, 2002, Edna was spotted getting into a vehicle outside a club in Edmonton, Alberta, and they specify that she was seen with unknown people getting into the car. The reason I specify unknown people, and we'll get into it a little bit later, but there is a, I guess, person of interest or a suspect in this case, but he's only a single person, so they don't say how many people or anything like that, but that kind of raises an alarm bell. Like, were multiple people involved, or.
Right, there's a discrepancy.
Right. Did she start off with multiple people and then was with a single person? Like, someone has some more information somewhere. The following day, she was found in a farmer's field. Her fingers had been broken. Her cause of death was strangulation. And she'd been set on fire after her death, according to the site justicefornativewomen.com.
Wow, it kind of speaks of possible torture. Because of the broken fingers, right?
It is a very, very, it seems to be a very violent death.
That's awful.
The location of her remains was in a wooded area on Range Road 245, just north of Rowley View Road, according to Red Power Media Press. I wasn't able to find much more information about her case other than the name of a potential suspect, as I've mentioned, and we'll be discussing that a little bit further in the second part of the episode. The second woman to go missing was named Katie Sylvia Ballantyne. Her family and friends called her by her middle name, so she went by Sylvia. According to a CBC profile on missing and murdered Indigenous women, Sylvia was described as a beautiful and kind person. She was 40 years old when she went missing. She had four children that she loved very much, but at that point in her life, she had moved away from her family. Her mother says that the reason she'd moved away is that she was addicted to crack and was working in the sex trade.
Okay, so we have a common denominator here.
Yeah, the biggest common pattern with all these women, I mean, for the most part they were working in the sex trade, but Amber Tucuro wasn't. But the two common things is they were both seen at some point hitchhiking, and they were all First Nations.
Right, okay.
So Sylvia's mother thinks that she moved away because she was basically just trying to shield her family of any worry and hurt that was associated with her lifestyle. She thought if she moved further away from her family, they didn't have to see what she was doing or going through.
I could see that. It makes sense in a way, like if you're trying to shield them.
Yeah, absolutely. On May 5th, 2003, Sylvia's friends reported her missing to the Edmonton Police Service. I did read in another article on Toronto.com that said that she'd actually been reported missing when she failed to show up in Saskatchewan to visit her children as she had planned. I guess it doesn't really matter whatever way it happened. She was reported missing. She'd last been seen in the downtown Edmonton area. A farmer found her remains a few months after she was reported missing on July 7th of 2003. And that was in a field near Leduc, Alberta. The Edmonton Police Service did some investigating of the downtown Edmonton area, and they scoured a a 160 square mile radius of Eastern Leduc, but it doesn't seem like they found anything of note or nothing that they reported anyway. Her mother, Victoria Morosti, feels like the case wasn't given a high priority because of her daughter's lifestyle.
Well, that's a common problem. We've heard that before.
Yeah, it is going to be a reoccurring theme through the different cases that we're going to look at today. On April 19th, 2015, a landowner near Leduc, Alberta, called the police to report he had found human remains in a field on his property. After checking the dental records, the police concluded that these were the remains of Dolores Dawn Brower. Brower, who worked in the sex trade, was last seen in 2004, hitching a ride in the Edmonton area. She was 33 years old at the time. It took almost a year for her family to report her missing, which might seem like a long time, but if she wasn't someone who was in touch with her family constantly or regularly, I can see how a birthday would pass or Christmas would pass, and then you'd start wondering, like, okay, normally she would contact us around this time. So I can see how that would happen.
Right.
Especially when it's a vulnerable person. It might take some time, but red flags still do go up because people know when their family normally contacts them, even if it isn't on a regular basis.
Yeah, and it just does explain why it's not immediate that they notice that somebody's gone missing. I mean, if you only talk to somebody once in a while, it's going to be a few weeks or months before you notice.
Again, it doesn't mean they didn't have a close relationship or didn't care for them. It just means that their communication was more sporadic.
Exactly.
After her remains were found, the police didn't immediately rule this a homicide. They said that they were going to be continuing to run tests and try to find a cause of death. Now, keep in mind that she went missing in 2004, and then the remains are only being found 11 years later, so I'm sure cause of death was probably not apparent right off the bat. As the police are continuing to run their tests, they actually made a pretty startling discovery. What they had on their hands wasn't just one set of remains, but they had two sets of human remains. They also had the remains of Corey Ottenbright. She was also found in that same field in Leduc, Alberta on that April 19th date. Corey was a sex trade worker who was reported missing by her family on May 9th, 2004 when she left for work. So she left around 10 p.m. She was on 118th Avenue in Edmonton, and she failed to return home. So she was reported missing pretty much immediately, according to the CBC News article.
So, I mean, I think it's fair to assume that it's the same person that put them there.
Their remains were found pretty much together.
Okay, so not like in the same-ish area, but like together.
My understanding is that after they found the remains and after they identified Dolores's remains, they realized there were two sets of remains mixed up. Now, this is what I understand from what the article says. Whichever way it was, they were extremely close together because they were found at the same time. And apparently this was just 8 kilometers away from the remains of two of the other women we're talking about today. So they don't specify exactly, because we're going to be talking about 5 different women and they don't specify which two, but you've got an 8 kilometer radius with 4 sets of remains.
Yeah, so 8 kilometers even, it's close.
Very close.
Like, it just sounds like somebody's using the area as a dumping ground.
Right. And the reason that they were able to identify Corey Ottenbright's remains was that she had actually volunteered her DNA to Project CARE. This project was initially formed to investigate the murders of vulnerable people from the downtown Edmonton area. But now their mandate is also to help keep them safe, according to the RCMP community website. So we'll actually be talking about Project CARE a little bit more in another episode, so I'm not going to go into great detail about them.
Did we say that every single victim, are they all Indigenous women?
Yes.
Okay.
So there's a couple of things here. There's a whole project dedicated to protecting these vulnerable people from, a lot of them were sex workers, but this means that they're being preyed upon at an alarming rate. Basically, they had to put together a task force to investigate because so many of them are going missing. Corey's family described her as a loving daughter, a partner, a sister, and a friend. She was only 27 years old at the time of her disappearance, according to the Gateway Gazette. So all of these women's stories are kind of familiar, unfortunately. I mean, I feel like we've heard these things so many times before, where it's someone who's a vulnerable person, they go missing. Police may or may not care all that much, or may or may not put all that much effort into investigating. And the numbers just pile up of these missing women.
Yeah, it does seem like a repeat story. And also, I mean, we've talked about it before, where the way that they depict them as they're standing in society, they kind of minimize it to the public too. And then the public kind of just doesn't seem to want to care that much.
It sort of reminds me, which you still hear it today, but much less, about how women used to be, or still are, blamed about sexual assault and rape because of the way they were dressed or where they were, or because they were drunk. And it used to be the woman's fault for doing those things, and that's why she was raped. And now the conversation's changing, where we're saying, like, it doesn't matter what a woman's doing, wearing, saying, or I shouldn't say a woman, but what a person's doing, wearing, or saying, they shouldn't get assaulted. Nothing of what they do, wear, say, or where they are is basically asking for assault.
Yeah, I actually saw something interesting last week about people tend to ask what the person was wearing, but let's not pretend that rape didn't exist in the 40s or 50s, or obviously forever, but like in those years where people wore long dresses that covered everything. They're just looked upon as substandard humans just because they're doing something that not everybody approves of, or they're doing it as a necessity for a drug habit. It doesn't make them less important.
Exactly. And they deserve just as much as anyone else to have their killers brought to justice.
Exactly.
These, like we're saying, these women's stories are really familiar because it's something that seems to happen much too often. But again, it doesn't get a lot of coverage. But there's another name that I've mentioned already that might be a little bit more familiar because her story has been talked about a little bit more, and that's the disappearance of Amber Tucuro. In 2010, Amber was 20 years old, and she had a 14-month-old son named Jacob that she absolutely adored. According to storiesoftheunsolved.com, Amber was living in the Fort McMurray area and was trying to make it on her own, but was having trouble finding housing. I've never lived in Alberta. I do know several people who lived in Fort McMurray, and what I've heard was that people would move there for work, but they would have plenty of money and still not be able to find a place to live because housing was very limited and extremely expensive.
Yeah, exactly. Something that would be like 200 grand around here in the Maritimes is like $1 million over there, if you can even find anything.
Exactly. Like, I've heard stories of people moving there and having great jobs and having plenty of money, and again, just cannot find a place to live because there's just none. I don't know if it's still like that, but back then it was a big boom town that was constructed. If I'm not mistaken, it was like around the oil industry, so it just kind of developed, but not quickly enough. So Amber was trying to find a place to live with her son to feel a little bit more independent. Amber would spend some time at Unity House, which was an organization that helped people find places to live, and she met a friend while she was there. And this friend would play a big role in her story. Now, I don't have that friend's name. She's not named in any of the articles, apparently because of the nature of the investigation. I did see a name pop up in certain blogs and things like that, but I'm not going to use it. I don't know if it was just like a pseudonym or if her name has become public, but because it's not in the articles, I'm not going to name her. This was the person that Amber was traveling with when she went missing. So this friend invited Amber to join her and a trip to Edmonton. I think they were just, you know, going to have a trip, kind of try to relax and have a little bit of fun. Amber decided to go along, and she was bringing her son Jacob with her. So they went ahead and booked plane tickets and decided to get a hotel near Edmonton in a place called Nixu. The reason they decided to stay there was because they could get rooms at a much lower price. According to a quick Google map search, it would have taken about 30 minutes to get into the city from there. Which, that's something that you and I have done before, where we've gone to see a concert in the city and stayed on the outskirts just because the rooms were cheaper.
Right, or because everything was rented out also.
Yeah. I've read a few different accounts as to what happened. In some accounts, she and her friend and her son Jacob arrived at the hotel, and Amber was really excited about going to Edmonton, so she decided to head downtown that same night. And then in other accounts that I read, they went to Edmonton, spent the day, went back to their hotel, and then Amber decided to head out again into the city. But regardless, it was August 18th, and it was between 7:30 and 8:30 p.m. when she decided to go. So she left her son with her friend in the hotel room and decided to hitchhike into the city. According to her CBC profile, Amber was really excited to be there and just wanted, I guess, to spend some time downtown. Again, my understanding of Fort McMurray is there wasn't necessarily a lot going on there. It was a pretty new place, so it was probably exciting to be in a bigger city. The next day, when Amber hadn't returned to her room, her friend called Amber's mother to let her know that her daughter was missing. Amber's mother knew that this isn't typical behavior for her daughter, so she was immediately worried. And she did what most of us would have done. She called the police. But the police's reaction was much less concerned. They basically told Amber's mother, Vivian, that her daughter was probably out partying and would come back at some point. Also, they told her she had to wait 24 hours before she could officially report her missing.
That old story again.
Yeah, that old story. I honestly feel like when people go missing, isn't it better to overreact than underreact?
I'd say, especially if it's something that's out of character.
Right. Amber was eventually placed on the missing person list, but because there had been some reported sightings of her, an officer just decided to remove her from the list, despite the fact that none of these sightings were confirmed. It took Vivian a month to get her daughter's name back on the missing person list. This was a waste of some precious time.
So does that mean nobody worked on it the whole time then?
I'm assuming when she was taken off the list, she wasn't considered missing anymore, so nobody was actively looking.
They didn't do anything. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Amber's mother wasn't interviewed for about 4 months after her daughter's disappearance. And her daughter's personal belongings ended up being destroyed by the police. So not only could have these things been evidence, but if they decided they didn't need them anymore, it should have been returned to the family.
So are we talking the things that were in the hotel room?
That's my understanding, yeah, the personal possessions okay. That she had. Her family wasn't aware that her items were being destroyed until after the fact.
Yeah, that's sad. That's not good.
With no leads in the investigation, in 2012, the police ended up releasing a one-minute clip from a 17-minute phone call that Amber had had with her brother on the night that she disappeared. Because her brother was in a remand center at the time of the call, it had been recorded. This call is taking place between Amber and her brother, and Amber is in a vehicle, so they believe whoever she was in the car with is potentially the person who, at this point, made her disappear, because as far as we know, she's just missing.
Okay.
So they believe this person, this man, because you do hear him on the call, had picked up Amber while she was hitchhiking. The police hoped that someone would be able to identify the voice of the man who was driving the vehicle, so that call was made public, which I also read in a CBC article that that was the first time in Canadian history that they'd done something like that. I'm going to play the 1 minute clip here so everyone can listen to it.
Where are we by?
We're just heading south of Beaumont, or north of Beaumont.
We're heading north of Beaumont. Yo, where are we going? No, this is a... Are you f***ing kidding me? You better not take me anywhere I don't want to go. I want to go into the city. Jeez. Yo, we're not going in the city, are we? No, we're not.
Yes.
Then where the f*** are these roads going to?
50th Street.
50th Street, are you sure?
Absolutely.
Yo, where are we going?
50th Street. What are your thoughts on what's going on there?
To me, it sounds like she's fearful.
I think so, too. So the 1 minute that they release, I feel is probably more toward... Well, I think it's the end of the phone call, because I think where it cuts off is where the call ends.
Yeah.
But I think she suddenly realized that they're not heading into Edmonton, as she thought.
Right.
And because the driver is still pretending that everything's okay, I'm just taking a back road, don't worry about it, and he's being very dismissive, I think you can kind of hear the panic mounting that she's like, oh my God, something bad is going to happen.
Yeah, like you can tell that the gut feeling's getting stronger, and it's like she knows what's happening.
Yeah. So the police released this clip to the public, and in what, as far as we know, must have been just a coincidence, a few days later, Amber's remains were found by some people on horseback. The remains were found on a property in Leduc, Alberta. So this is where we're going to end things for this week. Next week, we're going to explore a possible suspect for these crimes. This man is actually already in jail for another murder. If you can't wait until next week to hear the second part of this episode, it will be up on Patreon, so you can listen to it immediately. If you join us on Patreon, it's all ready to go. Otherwise, you'll have access to it next week, and we're going to talk about the aftermath of these findings and, as I mentioned, a potential suspect. Winding down with our moment of kindness, I want to talk about an article that I saw on the CBC website. This happened in New Brunswick. There was a couple driving home one day, and they saw what they thought initially was a pile of garbage on the side of the road. But as they were driving by, they realized it was a person that was kind of wrapped up, just huddled up there. And they stopped to pick him up and give him a drive home. Turns out it was a veteran who'd been living in a trailer. So they gave him a ride home. They've actually become friends since then, and they will stop by and visit him and bring food and things like that. They did make sure to say that this man that they picked up was not looking for any charity or anything like that, but they found that just getting to know him and connecting with him has been very rewarding for them. So I thought that was a nice gesture, but also it goes to show that being kind to someone is often as rewarding to yourself as it can be to the person you're showing kindness to. It was a nice gesture that seemed to have brought a lot to both the man they picked up and to themselves. Thanks to everyone who's been listening. You can find us on Instagram at Crime and Mystery Canada. Don't forget, we're going to be doing a draw for the book I'll Be Gone in the Dark. We'll be drawing the book next week, and you can find the information on that on our Instagram account. You can also join our Facebook group, Crime and Mystery Canada, or write us at crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com. Have a good night, everyone, and stay safe out there.